We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
The unmistakable opening of Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, one of America's most recognized and beloved composers of the 20th century. This is Afternoon Magazine. I'm Leanne Donner, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Our guest today is Walter Rimler, Gershwin scholar, author of A Gershwin Companion and Fade Away, a comparison of jazz age with rock era pop song composers. And today we'll talk about his most recent book, George Gershwin, An Intimate Portrait, published, I'm pleased to say, by the University of Illinois Press. And of course, you're welcome to join in on the conversation this afternoon at 1-800-222-9455 or locally 333-9455. Walter Rimler, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
First of all, tell us about your musical journey. What brought you to write about George Gershwin?
Well, I guess to go back to the beginning, when I was a kid and still into baseball, I think I was in middle school, I came down with the flu, and I was lying there with a high fever, and for some reason, I don't know why, my mother put on a record. I'm not sure who bought it, and it was a recording of the Rhapsody in Blue, and somehow, with my fever and with those wonderful rhythms of the Rhapsody and then that tremendous melody, it just won me over not only to Gershwin but to music. It was the moment that I became in love with music, and especially Gershwin.
And how old were you then?
I think I was about 14. I think I had just switched from watching the World Series to listening to all the music I could get my ears on.
And so did you study then music formally?
I began to study music to some extent. I was always sort of a dilettante. As soon as I began studying piano, I began writing music. Nothing real serious, but I would much rather write tunes and mess around that way than actually study and practice. So, and that's the way it's continued to this day.
Well, George Gershwin's childhood seems like it was not one particularly conducive to producing not one, but really two musical geniuses. Can you talk to us a little bit about Gershwin's interesting family?
Yeah, it was very odd. Well, his mother and father were not musical at all, unless you want to consider the fact that his father would sometimes take a comb out and put some tissue paper over the comb and blow onto it and make a strange sound. That was as musical as his family ever got, and they tried to trace back to see if there were any musicians, but there were none going back in the Gershwin family, which went back to Russia, St. Petersburg. George was another interesting case because he was really not all that into music until he was about 12 or maybe 13. He was mostly a street kid, and he liked to steal stuff and play hooky and be a bad guy and skip school, especially skip music, people playing music at school auditoriums. Well, one day he was at on the ball field skipping a musical event, and he heard the violin coming from the auditorium, and he just stood there transfixed, and all of a sudden music hit him, and not only as a fan, but he soon realized that he had this just overwhelming talent. He knew it. It didn't take long for him to understand the nature of his talent. And I think he went from being somebody who didn't have any direction. In fact, his parents thought that his direction was pretty much going to be Sing Sing or some other jail. and he felt like he had been given a direction and been given something truly wonderful, and he felt his whole life an obligation to do the best he could by the talent he had been given. And he was wonderstruck by it, as was everybody else who came into contact with him.
But he didn't really pursue it in sort of the normal channels of a child who then starts to take lessons and studies music theory.
Well, with Gershwin, as it was throughout his life, he went both ways. He had after a series of pretty bad piano teachers, he had one really good one. And this good teacher, called Charles Hambitzer, was a classical music pianist. He was one of the first to play Schoenberg, and this was in like 1915, and Berg and the modernists, and Debussy particularly, and the French modernists. But he also, Hambitzer also wrote for the Schubert organization and wrote light operas. So he was not averse to the fact that Gershwin just gravitated naturally toward popular music. Although Gershwin loved to go to symphony concerts, and he kept a scrapbook of all the concerts he went to. If Paderewski was playing, Gershwin would cut out that review and put it in a scrapbook. And those scrapbooks can be found these days in the Library of Congress. Ira kept them all, and they're deposited there if you want to look at them. It's fun to look through.
Well, let's talk about Ira for a moment. He was originally the musician in the family.
Well, the Gershwin mother, who in my book I explain was not the world's greatest mother in some ways, she pretty much ignored her four children in favor of going to the racetrack and gambling and having a good time. And she saw that her younger sister had purchased secondhand a piano, and she was not somebody who would stand for having her sister have a better have a piano when she didn't herself have one, so she bought one. And since she had a piano, she figured she ought to make the oldest son, Ira, who was 2 years older than George, be the one to take the lessons. And Ira was trying to think of some way to get out of it, but he couldn't. But he did get out of it when George walked over and, to everybody's surprise, started knocking out a tune. His left hand would go back and forth like a ragtime pianist, and he just seemed to be able to play the piano, and nobody could figure out how. Actually, he'd been practicing at a friend's house, and he'd also been going to Harlem and hanging out with the great Harlem pianists, pretty much attaching himself to them, Lucky Roberts and U.B. Blake, and that's the direction he wanted to go, to play popular music and to play the complicated ragtime jazz music that was then in vogue.
So he was studying just not the usual formal track that we all think of when we think of...
Well, he studied, and he loved studying. He loved going to music lessons, and he was given Chopin, and he loved Chopin, and he loved Debussy, and he loved Ravel. Anything they gave him, he loved. He even loved the William Tell Overture. But when it came time to be on his own, his natural inclination was to love Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern more than anybody else. And those were his models as composers. And his models as pianists weren't Horowitz or Paderewski or Rachmaninoff, as great as they were. They were Lucky Roberts and many of the black stride pianists in Harlem. Those were the ones he wanted to be like.
Now, you tell us in your book that Ira sort of followed the normal path. He got married. He started a family, but for George, things went a little differently.
Well, it's a complicated situation. Ira and George weren't close as kids. Ira was the one who his parents always sent to get George out of trouble. And he would go to school to talk his teachers out of expelling him. And I think Ira must have resented being the one to do that, because he wasn't that much older than George. And he was also the one made to work, do the work, not the other kids. His father had like 20 businesses in a row, including a billiard table, a billiard parlor, and a hotel, and a sauna, and I think he ran a numbers racket for a while. And Ira would always have to be the one who was involved with that, while George got to run free in the streets. As far as their musical getting together musically. They weren't that close as kids. But George quit high school to become what was called a piano pounder, which meant that he went to, he was employed by a music publisher, and he would sit in a little cubicle, and he would play the publisher's songs for vaudevillians who would come by, and hopefully they would buy the songs and make some money for the publisher. It's interesting to note that a couple of those vaudevillians were a teenage dance act named Fred and Adele Astaire. They were teenagers, and so was Gershwin. And they, after Gershwin played them some of the songs by the publisher, he played them a few of his own songs, and almost like Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland style, they sat around musing, wouldn't it be great if we could put a show together on Broadway? And that's what happened. In the meantime, Ira, what he liked best to do was sit at home and read. He was literary from the beginning. And he gravitated toward Tin Pan Alley, as George had, but not on George's coattails. Ira was careful to use a pseudonym because George was building a reputation. And he made it on his own, using a pseudonym derived from the names of his younger brother and sister, Arthur Francis. And he was a pretty well-known lyricist before he and George got together as a team. And once that happened, they became two of the great names on Broadway, as were Fred and Adele Astaire.
Do you think that Ira was resentful of George's talent?
I don't think so. In fact, all evidence points that he was just as agog as everybody else by the fact that this ne'er-do-well brother of his turned out to be a genius. And the one most amazed by it was George. He could not believe his luck. So he had this reputation of telling everybody, can you believe how great I am? But he wasn't saying it because he was bragging. He was saying it like, how about this? Isn't this amazing? And it was lovable. It was a lovable quality. And Ira believed that George was vastly talented, probably more talented than anybody else. And that was an era when there was a whole lot of talent around, as we all know. But George seemed to be the one that everybody looked to as really the singular talent of the age. And Ira was not jealous of him. He admired him greatly.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, George went to Europe to study primarily, so that he could compose?
Yes, he did. He was a dilettante in the way that he studied. He kept asking, whenever he met a concert composer such as Stravinsky, and he met a lot of them after writing Rhapsody in Blue, he was world famous, he would almost obsessively say, can I study with you? And they would almost always reply, why be a second-rate Stravinsky or a second-rate Ravel when you can be a first-rate Gershwin? They all saw his talent. Although they didn't all think that he was cut out to be a classical composer. They all sort of looked down on him in that regard. They believed his true art lay in his songs. And you asked me earlier about Ira settling down and George not settling down. There's a long story involved there. George was a womanizer probably pretty early on, and we're talking teenage years, maybe before. Ira was pretty much standoffish toward that sort of thing, mostly because he was tremendously shy, and he didn't believe that any woman could possibly be interested in him, and he couldn't put himself forward. George had no trouble doing that. But they seemed to have the same crowd, and in that crowd were two sisters. One was Emily, the older, and one was Lenore, the younger. George adored Emily, and Ira probably did too. But Emily was engaged to be married to a man named Paley, and George was great friends with him. And George was not averse to going out with married women, but he never did anything in that sort with Emily, who he adored them both, and Ira didn't either. But the sister, Lenore Strunsky, Emily's younger sister, was available, and she worked pretty hard first to try to get George, and when he kind of held her at arm's length, she worked hard to get Ira, and she managed to do that. That's sort of the story of how Ira became married. George continued unmarried to the end of his life, playing the field. Ira and Lenore never had children. I think, as far as I can tell, Ira wanted children, but Lenore did not.
And then there was Kay.
Then there was Kay. About the same time, Ira and Lenore were getting married. And this is interesting because at about that time, George and Ira had a show on Broadway called OK. It's O-H, K-A-Y, exclamation point. In that show was a song called Someone to Watch Over Me. And Ira had just gotten married. And it was sort of a marriage song to Lenore. And in the lines, he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome, Ira was referring to himself. As far as the title of the show, O.K., George was referring to Kay Warburg. Her name at the time was Catherine Warburg, who he had fallen in love with. She was married to a very prominent banking family, James Warburg, who was the son of Paul Warburg, and that family went back centuries as far as being a great banking family. But George fell in love with Kay because she almost, but not quite, met all the amazingly, he had an amazing number of criteria that he wanted in a woman, and no woman on earth has ever filled that bill. But she came pretty close. She was beautiful. She was a wonderful lover. She could make terrific parties. But most of all, she was a musician. She had been a prodigy, and she was a wonderful pianist, a terrific composer. She knew a whole lot about music, especially about opera. And she could coach him in his desire to become a classical composer. And at the same time, he coached her, because she looked down a little bit on popular music, although she liked jazz. He coached her in becoming a composer of popular songs, and she made quite a success of herself. She was the first woman to write a complete Broadway show, the composer of a complete Broadway show called Fine and Dandy, and there were a couple of enduring hits from that show.
And thanks to her love of George, she and James, or Jimmy, had quite a modern marriage.
Well, it's a little bit hard to understand, but maybe not. He sort of looked the other way while they engaged in a 10-year affair. Jimmy and Kay had three small children, all daughters. But Kay was so in love with George, and he and her with her, although he played the field, and he needed her. He needed her musically, and he needed her for emotional support, and he loved her. And for 10 years, they were a duo seen around town. They would pop up everywhere in Harlem, at the Metropolitan Opera Company. They were always around, and they were very close. And in many biographies prior to mine, that fact is not prominently dealt with for a number of reasons, which we can get into. But eventually she divorced James with the hope that George would marry her. And in the end, he chose not to marry her. What happened was, after the failure of Porky and Bess, which crushed him, he decided to go to Hollywood to write songs for the movies, and he figured that this was the chance to make a break with her, and they had a deal, or at least he had a deal, that he and she would not communicate for the time he was in Hollywood or in Beverly Hills, and if that year did not work out, they would get back together. And as we know now, that year didn't work out in more ways than one. He died before he could get back to New York, and he never did get back together with him, although they did communicate toward the very end of his life.
You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with Walter Rimler, who's the author of George Gershwin, An Intimate Portrait. You can join in on the conversation by calling 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Paint for us, if you will, a picture of the New York parties with George Gershwin and Kay and the many other musicians. Quite the roaring 20s.
Well, it was like that. At the very beginning, before George and Ira were famous, as they were just beginning, the parties were held at Lenore's sister's house. What's her name? Strunsky, Eleanor Strunsky. And these were very small affairs in a Greenwich Village apartment. with a few people stopping by, all very bright, and they included people who later became famous. A couple of actors who would always be there were Edward G. Robinson and Sam Jaffe. Composers included Mark Blitzstein and Vincent Humans. So it was quite a collection of people, but none of them had yet achieved fame. And it was a fun salon. And the height of the evening would be George going to the piano and mesmerizing everybody. But as time went on, and after Ira married Lenore, the salon, the Gershwin Salon, became Lenore's property. And she and Ira lived next door to George. In fact, they had a connecting passageway, so they didn't have to leave the house to see each other. And the salon included many more people. It was people from all walks of life. You could see Stravinsky there. Aaron Copland would come by. And Lenore Gershwin became the head of the party situation. However, Kay was at least as adept at giving parties as Lenore. Moreover, Kay was an artist, and Lenore was not. And I think Lenore feared what would happen to her place in the family should George marry Kay. If George married Kay, it would be pretty much put Lenore in the as a backbencher in the Gershwin world. Of course, George never did marry Kay, but she threw some of the most wonderful parties for him. Whenever he had a Broadway opening, she was the one who threw the party. And when Porgy and Bess opened, she threw a massive party in which hundreds of people were invited. She got Condé Nast, I believe his name is, the magazine publisher, to donate his apartment. She hired a couple of bands. And the day after the party was over, as the newspapers were coming out with the bad reviews, she was on her way to the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia to deliver a lecture on Porgy and Bess, the first one where she played examples from the piano. She was loyal to him, as loyal as one could possibly be.
One of the most beloved, I keep using that word, but it is so appropriate to George Gershwin, works that he did was An American in Paris. And you tell a wonderful story in your book about duo pianist Jacques Frey and Mario Bragiotti coming in and sort of seeing the composer at work. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, that really was a wonderful find for me. It was in an oral history, I believe, from I think it's in the Yale collection. It might be in the Columbia collection. What happened with An American in Paris was, to start the story, I don't know if there's time for this, so let me know if
You're fine.
I'm going too long, but Gershwin had met Ravel. When Ravel came to the United States in 1928, it was his 53rd birthday, and they asked him what he wanted for his 53rd birthday, and he said he wanted to meet George Gershwin. And to Gershwin, this was just a tremendous thing because he was used to being put down by the great classical composers. And to have someone of Ravel's stature wanting to meet him was just an amazing thing. And he asked Ravel, of course, as he always did, "Can I study with you?" And Ravel said, "It's a whole lot better, as usual, to be a first-rate Gershwin than a second-rate Ravel. But what I will do is write you a letter of introduction to a wonderful piano and composition teacher in Paris named Nadia Boulanger, if I have the pronunciation correct. She was in Paris teaching many of the expatriate American composers, including George Antheil and Virgil Thompson and Aaron Copland and Roy Harris and a bunch of others. So Gershwin thought, this is a good chance for me to actually get some formal training in music. And he went to Paris, and he brought the letter with him to Boulanger. And she told him, without any of Ravel's warmth, that she had nothing she could teach him. So you can wonder what she meant. Did she mean that he was unable to understand the wonderful tidbits she was gladly dispensing to all the other composers? Or did she mean, like all the other classical bigwigs, that he was himself and he didn't need anybody's help? It's not clear. But what he did go back to his hotel, which was the most expensive hotel in Paris, which really angered all the American composers who were living hand-to-mouth. to have this famous, world-famous guy come breeze into Paris, check into the most famous hotel, and begin writing a composition, which they had a feeling was going to be a crowd pleaser. And so he had a hotel, he had a piano brought to his hotel room, and he was working on the piece. And he and a friend had gone downtown to procure some taxi horns that would make specific sounds of specific notes. And he was working on that part of the piece, which begins is at the beginning. And there was a knock on the door, and two pianists knocked. They were students, and they said, "Mr. Gershwin, we would love to meet you." And he, in his fashion, he was a very welcoming, open person. He said, "Come on in, boys. I need your help on these taxi horns. Now, I'm going to play this part, and when I go whack, 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 you pump on the taxi horns." They were the kind that looked like they like Clarabelle's kind of horns, you know, where you...
With a bulb.
With a bulb at the end. And so they did it, and they were all laughing and having a good time. And in that oral interview... they discuss, or one of them discusses, what it was like to be with Gershwin in that room as he was having a great time composing what turned out to be a truly wonderful piece of music.
It is, and if you don't mind, we're going to listen to a little bit of that for just a moment.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
You have to wonder how hard he worked to find horns that made the notes that he wanted to.
Well, apparently, according to Jacques, he had about 15 or 16 horns on the piano all laid out. So he was trying to find the ones that would play the exact notes he wanted. So he worked hard. His friend Mabel Shermer, who was also related to Emily and Lenore, she was a cousin, she was in Paris at the time, and she spoke French. So he and she went to the auto parts stores in downtown and bought the taxi horns. And she could say what exactly he wanted because she could speak French.
I wonder if conductors today try to find horns that match the right pitches.
It's interesting. I believe you're playing orchestras. You might know what orchestras keep on hand when they play an American in Paris. I think they all keep on hand, somewhere in the back room, a few taxi horns to play the correct notes. I'm not sure.
I think that's probably correct. Well, Gershwin's life was full of great successes and great failures. His life is this giant, giant arc toward a tragic ending, but there are many smaller arcs inside it. Could you talk for a moment about some of his professional failures that are on a smaller scale?
Well, his career, he died at the age of 38. And his career, if you want to say how long it was, really was about 20 years. Although his fame, and he really got the hang of being George Gershwin in about 1924, so he only had about 13 years to write his great works. And in the 1920s, which are about half of that period, he could do no wrong, pretty much. He had a couple of flop shows, it's true. But he wrote wonderful pieces for orchestra, the Concerto in F and Rhapsody in Blue and American in Paris, and they became popular, especially Rhapsody in Blue and American in Paris. Then the 1930s came along, and he still had successes on Broadway, but his classical pieces didn't capture the attention of the audience. He wrote a piece called The Second Rhapsody, and he had a lot of reviews in the paper in which reviewers, principally Owen Downs of the New York Times, would say it's a lot easier for Gershwin to write a tune than to develop it. And in the Second Rhapsody, it was almost as if he was trying to prove the opposite. He wrote a number of tunes, some of them quite nice, but not really Rhapsody in Blue quality, and he developed them. And the review said that Gershwin is better at developing his material, but isn't so good at writing it anymore. He just couldn't seem to win. And then he wrote a piece called The Cuban Overture, which Kay Swift believed was his best. She called it his sexiest. He wrote it shortly after his father died, though, so after the sexy part comes his lamentation in the middle, which is a very haunting, beautiful piece of music. But he gave the piece at an all-Gershwin concert at Lewiston Stadium with about 20,000 people listening, and nobody knows it, and it has never caught on. But it's well worth listening if anybody wants to listen to Cuban Overture. It was originally called Rumba, but he changed the name. And then, as he was about to begin Porgy and Bess, he wrote a very short piece for a concert tour called Variations on I Got Rhythm for piano and orchestra. It's charming. It has lots of interesting and complicated piano parts, and he was writing it for an orchestra the size of the one he would write for in Porgy and Bess, but it was not concerto in F. So he had several failures, and then his Broadway shows began to fail, one after the other. The sequel to Of Thee I Sing, which had been in 1931 a big hit, the sequel was called Let Him Eat Cake, and it was a big bomb. And then he had another bomb. He knew it was coming, but he wrote it out of a sense of obligation to the producers. It was pretty awful, although there were a couple of good songs there, too. And then came Porgy and Bess, which he put his heart and soul into.
And
he lavished all the love he had on the characters in Porgy and Bess. It's very important to understand that.
And that Porgy and Bess was something that he thought about for a long time and came back to before he finally sat down to write it.
It came out 9 years after he originally proposed the idea to the writer of the novel, DuBose Hayward. It took him a long time to believe he was ready to do it because it meant that he would have to write for chorus, for orchestra, for soloist, and have to get the scenes and the leitmotifs integrated into a coherent fashion. And he was always put down for being unable to do those various things. And he knew that should he do it and fail, he would be considered a failure. Despite his great songs and despite all he had written, he knew it was could be his Waterloo. And he was worried. Finally, he took the challenge. And then there was also the fact that in the 1930s, Rodgers and Hart leading the way toward the Broadway musical, that seemed to be the direction of Broadway. And here was Gershwin, who grew up the son of immigrants, who believed that opera was where one ought to go if one wrote for the theater, because they came from Europe, where opera houses were the sign of culture. So in a kind of a quixotic way, Gershwin, while others were heading toward what became the Broadway musical, beginning with Oklahoma, he was heading toward opera. And he knew all these pitfalls, and he knew that he wouldn't be writing too much with Ira. He'd be writing with a writer, DuBose Hayward, who had never written a song before. What he didn't know and didn't seem to understand was that in writing for black people, writing a story about black people, he would be taking on what was about to become the civil rights movement. Not taking it on, but he, living in the 30s, would be unable to escape the 30s completely, and would write a show in which some measure of black people could be a little unhappy at how they were depicted in the show. However, Gershwin loved each character in the show, and if you listen to it and read the libretto, it is nothing but positive about the people he was writing about. And it took about 60 years for that to become clear to people, and it's clear now.
What do you think attracted him to the character of Porgy?
You know, for one thing, DuBose Hayward was attracted to Porgy because Hayward was, he was a descendant of a man who signed the Declaration of Independence and a slaveholder, but by the time DuBose Hayward came along, his family was in poverty, and his father, when DuBose was two or three, died as a mill worker in an accident. Then DuBose contracted polio, and his left arm became unusable. He worked on the docks alongside of black dock workers, and he studied the language, which was sort of different than other language. It was called Gullah, and it was a combination of 17th century English and West African dialects. So he read an article in a newspaper about a black man who had no legs and was pulled around on a cart that was The main power of the cart was provided by a goat, and he was being chased by the police. The police were chasing this poor, really poor beggar of a black man who was crippled, and it just struck him. It just got to him in his heart, and that's how he wrote the book Porgy. Now, as for Gershwin, Gershwin, of course, did not have polio, but he felt that, as a Jewish person, he felt sympathy for black people who were being subjected to, they were basically bullied, and the Jews were bullied. Gershwin knew that, he knew that in Florida there were signs saying no dogs and Jews allowed on the beaches. He was unable to get into a country club because he was Jewish. He tried once to check into a hotel, but they wouldn't let him in. And this was when he was world famous because he was Jewish. He understood that people belong to bullied groups of people, and he felt an empathy in that way. So that's where he came in on Porgy and Bess. He wanted to write that story, and he found it very hard to fall convincingly in love with any woman, but he certainly fell convincingly in love with the characters of Porgy and Bess, especially.
He also wanted Porgy to make sure that the singers were black, that this was not white people portraying black people in this opera.
A very brief opera when he was in his early 20s, and there were white singers who put on blackface and sang for about a half an hour. It got terrible reviews. It was pretty ridiculous, and it made him sick to his stomach, and he never quite got over that, and he resolved he would never do anything like that again. So he would not accept white singers putting on blackface. It had to be black singers, and not only that, he wanted black singers who were conservatory trained. So in auditioning the people for Porgy and Bess, he selected people who were extremely erudite as far as opera went, more so than he was, and he learned from them, and they were a tremendous collection of talent, and he felt that black people ought to portray themselves on stage.
It's hard to talk about Porgy and Bess without listening to something from it. So if you don't mind, we're gonna hear one of the more favorite tunes from Porgy and Bess now. Well, with Porgy and Bess, Gershwin really helped start the careers of a group of black singers.
One thing to remember about Summertime, which is just gorgeous, and that was a wonderful performance, is there's a certain sadness to it, and there's a sadness to just about everything in Porgy and Bess. Maybe I Got Plenty of Nothing excluded, and a couple others I Can't Sit Down. But there's a sadness to Summertime, and the reason for that is because the baby would lose both of his parents, Clara, who sings the song, and Jake, who would lose both of his parents to a hurricane later in the opera. Jake is out on a fishing boat during the opera. He knows a hurricane's coming, but he has to fish to earn money for the child's education. That's what they're counting on. And they both die, and the baby becomes an orphan. So there's a certain sadness, although there's a certain tranquility in those beautiful chords. But people should realize when they hear Summertime or when they sing it that there's a great sadness there too.
And a great sadness in Gershwin's life coming to an end at such a young age.
Well, not only the fact that he died young, but the way he died is just tremendously sad, because he came to Hollywood and he began having headaches while he was working on films for the movies. And he began having these phantom garbage smells. And then he began acting a little differently than he normally had. And everybody, all of his friends, who included very brilliant people like Lillian Hellman and Ira and Lenore and others, they thought that he was having a nervous breakdown. And even doctors he went to came to the same conclusion. And so the final film he worked on, The Goldwyn Follies, which was being financed by Samuel Goldwyn, Gershwin, his headaches were so bad at that point that he would spend most of his time sitting in his room on the floor holding his head. But Samuel Goldwyn insisted that Gershwin come to the studio and play the songs he had written so far. And Gershwin never said no to things like that. Jerome Kern, a year earlier, had been asked by David Selznick to come play what he had written for a movie Selznick was paying for. And Kern said, "I don't play samples." But Gershwin, of course, he was always ready to do that, and he went despite being ill, and he played the songs he had written for Samuel Goldwyn. Two of those songs, one of them was Love Walked In, and the second, which he never was well enough to write completely on paper, but he finished writing the music, was later called, after he died, by Ira, Love Is Here to Stay. Now, Love Is Here to Stay was Love Walked In was prominently displayed in the movie, but Samuel Goldwyn didn't like any of the songs he heard that day, and he told Gershwin, "Hey, look, why don't you write hits like Irving Berlin?" And Gershwin went home, and in the last days of his life, that sentence kept echoing in his head, "Why don't you write hits like Irving Berlin?" There's nothing wrong with writing like Irving Berlin, but Gershwin felt he had gone maybe a little bit past Irving Berlin at that point, and it bothered him a lot. And the second thing was that he began fumbling with his utensils as he tried to eat, and he became the brain tumor that he had was just taking its toll on him. Once he went gamely to lunch with Lenore and Ira, and coming out of the restaurant, they were at the Brown Derby, he fell on the sidewalk, and Lenore said, "Don't help him up. He's just having one of his artistic temper tantrums." Mm. We don't know how he got up. Maybe he got himself up. Maybe Ira finally disobeyed his wife, which is hard to believe. Maybe some good Samaritan came by and picked him up. But this was the kind of life he lived. And at the very end of his life, Lenore became so sick of dealing with what she thought was a guy acting up to get attention, she kicked him out of the house, a house he was renting. He was paying the rent along with them, and he moved to a smaller house that had been vacated by a songwriter friend, and that's where he went into a coma and died, but not before he finally had control over his own phone. Lenore had controlled the phone in the house they were living at, and he got in touch with Kay, and they spoke. She never said what they talked about except to say that he told her he was coming back for both of them, and she said that he was very brave about it.
We have to wrap it up right there, I'm sorry to say, but could I get you just to read to us the first paragraph of your author's note at the end of your book?
I'll be happy to do that. Let me just turn to it here. Okay. George Gershwin lived his life with purpose and gusto, but with melancholy as well, for he was unable to make a home for himself, no familial home, and no home in music. The contrast between his élan and these struggles, ending in the horror of his final days, gives a dramatic arc to his biography and gives it the shape of a story.
Well, thank you so much, Walter Rimler, for talking with us this afternoon about your wonderful book, George Gershwin, An Intimate Portrait.
Well, thank you, Lee. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book.
We're going to go out with a little bit of Gershwin that is not as familiar to most people. It's his lullaby for strings.
Very early work.
Very early work.
Thank you.
It is 1:52, and the settlement prices are in from the Boards of Trade in Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. This is the way the numbers settled up in Chicago. On this Thursday afternoon, futures in the wheat pit like this for the day. The nearby December contract, a high price at $4.76¾ on its trade, down to a low of $4.58. A loss today in that December contract, a settlement price 5.5 cents lower at $4.61¾ a bushel for the soft red December wheat contract. March futures there, $4.96 the high, the low at 78. Settlement price at $4.81½, down 5.5 in the May. 5.07¼ the high, the low at $4.91¾. Settlement price at $4.94, down 5.5 in July contract. $5.11 the high, the low at $5.01. Settled 5.05¾, down 4.5. September contract, $5.26 the high, the low at 17. Settlement price at $5.21. The soft red September, down 4.5 cents. From Kansas City, nearby December contract, a high price today at $4.88, a low at $4.70¾. That hard red contract at $4.74¼ on the lead option, December, down 5¾ the March there, 6 cents lower at $4.90½. Back in Chicago, where they trade corn at the CME Group, nearby contract, that's the December harvest month, $3.41½ the high price, the low at $3.22¾ the settlement price. Down 7¼ at $3.29 for the December corn. March futures, $3.54½ the high, the low at $36¼. Settlement price at $3.42¼, down 7¼. And the May futures, $3.63 the high, the low at $45½. Settlement price at $3.51½, down 7¼. July futures, $3.71 the high, the low at $53¾. Settled at $3.60¼, down 6¾. September futures for the corn pit, $3.80 the high, the low at $62½. September of next year settled $3.68¾, down 6½ cents. And December 2010 contract, a loss today, down 6 cents for the new crop corn. That bean next year of 2010, $3.90 the high, the low at $72½. December 2010 settled $3.78¾, down 6 cents. December oats today, $2.20¾ for the high. Range to a low of $2.12¾. Settlement price at $2.14, 3¼ lower. March futures at $2.32½ top, bottom at $2.27½, settled at $2.27. Finished down 3¼ for the March oat futures. Now the soy complex, nearby November beans, and November and January were both higher, but the rest of that pit was lower for the day. That November contract at $9.62¾ top, bottom at $9.37¼, settlement price at $9.53, 2½ cents higher on the day. January futures, $9.65¾ the high, the low at $41½. Settlement price up a penny and a quarter at $9.56¼. March futures on out were lower or down. Nearby contract at $9.64½ for that March high. The low at $43¾. Settlement price at $9.55½. March beans down a penny and a quarter. May futures, $9.67¾ the high, the low at $42. Settlement price at $9.51½, a nickel lower. And the July contract in the bean pit, 6½ cents the loss, $9.68 the top, the bottom at $42¼. Settlement price at $9.52, down 6½ cents. Next year's November soybean contract, the loss today of 12 cents, down 12 at $9.18 with a high price of $9.35, a low at $9.12½. Once again, the November 2010 contract in the bean pit, down 12 cents at $9.18. October bean meal, $301.30 the high, the low at $292.70 a ton, settlement price at $299, up $1.20. December futures, $297.70 the high, the low at $288, settled $293.30, finished down 70 cents, and the October soybean oil, $34.75 the high, the low at $34.15, settlement price at $34.55, 17 cents higher. December futures, $35.20 the high, the low at $34.48, settlement price at $34.96. And it finished 18 cents higher. Over at the Mercantile Exchange, livestock side of the CME Group, nearby October contract now, $1.20 lower. $86.95 the high for the October live cattle futures. The low at $85.75, settlement price at $85.77½, down $1.20. December futures, $86.40 the high, the low at $85.25. Settlement price at $85.35, down $1.30. February live cattle futures, $87.47.5, the high, the low at $86.50. Settlement price at $86.55, down $1.17.5. And the April futures, $89.50, the high, the low at $88.50. Settlement price at $88.52.5, down $107.5. Feeder cattle futures now. Nearby contract in the September, $98.10, the high, the low at $96.60. Settlement price at $96.65, down $1.62.5. The October, $98.15, the high, the low at $96.50. Settled $96.70, down $1.75. In November, $98.30, the high, the low at $96.90. Settlement price $97, even down $1.55. January futures $99.05, the high, the low at $98. Settled $98.25, that's $98.25 for the January feeders at $1.05 lower on the afternoon. October lean hog futures 27.5 cents lower today to settle at $52.72.5 with a high of $53.55 and a low at $52.05. December contract a $52.65 high, low at $51.30. Settlement price at $52.02, finished 57.5 cents higher for the December lean hog futures. February contract 58.85, the high, the low at 57.55, settled 58.32.5, 47.5 higher. And the April lean hogs today, $64, the high, the low at 62.75, settlement price at $63, up 12.5 cents. Pork bellies, February contract, 2.5 cent gain, $87, the high, the low at 86.10, settled 86.60, up 2.5. The March frozen bellies at 85.30, finished unchanged on the afternoon. During the closing mark report this afternoon, comes up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's not too terribly far away now. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois. Dave Dickey will be along with all the agricultural news and some information about an ag panel that he'll be hosting this evening in Remington, Indiana. Dave will be on his way there shortly. And then we'll also hear this afternoon about the agricultural weather forecast from Peter Levitt. That all comes up during the closing mark report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com. Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Here's the weather forecast for the two-state region from our own chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser. He says tonight in the north and central section should be mostly clear. In the south, increasing cloudiness, some showers arriving near the Ohio River overnight. Lows were